From Iowa Public Radio, this is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the Iowa legislative session. I'm John Pimble.
It's labor in the house! Lay out, I can't hear ya! Come on, get up!
On Monday night, Danny Homan riles up a crowd of around 1,000 public employees on the rotunda floor at the Capitol.
We're gonna fight till we take back our state, because it belongs to you, the people, not these Republican legislators.
He's the president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. For three decades, he is often front and center advocating for union rights. Tonight, this organized rally of union and state workers is here to oppose legislation that would change collective bargaining laws for around 180,000 public employees.
If you come after one of us, you're going to come after all of us.
Andy Bredesen is a business representative for Sheet Metal Workers Local 45.
We're going to unite and hopefully vote these people back out of office that are making just horrible policies for not only the state, this country.
In a room near the rotunda, an evening public hearing begins. It's projected on a video screen for the mass of people to see and hear.
As a teacher, if I am successful, our students are successful.
1,100 people signed up to speak, but only 33 are allowed due to its allotted time of 2 hours. 29 speak against changes to collective bargaining, like Ann Swenson, an elementary teacher from Waukee.
This legislation not only doesn't help us in our efforts to recruit, hire, and retain the most talented teachers, it undermines us. It is an attack on our profession.
All of this attention is about a bill introduced by Republicans a week ago Tuesday. That's 6 days before this rally. It will change the benefits public workers receive through union negotiations. It will modify a 1974 law listed under Chapter 20 of Iowa's code. It's called collective bargaining because it allows workers' contracts to be negotiated as collective groups within their unions. It lets unions go to the state departments to determine what benefits and compensation these public workers will receive, whether they are part of a union or not. Under Chapter 20, the state is obligated to negotiate items including wages, health insurance, vacation, seniority, safety rules, working conditions, and overtime. The proposed legislation will basically only allow wages to be negotiated except for police and firefighters. Tuesday through Thursday, the bill is debated simultaneously in the House and Senate. It's a contentious debate lasting hours and hours with bitterness and sharp words delivered in both chambers, including this remark from Representative Dave Jacoby.
The bill is bullshit.
We will hear more moments of the long debate at the end of this podcast. But first, a discussion about the proposed law from the Capitol's Law Library. It's part of the talk show River to River from Monday afternoon. The guests are Republican Senator Jason Schultz and Democratic Senator Nate Bolton. Senator Schultz is the floor manager for the bill. Senator Bolton opposes. With the senators in the library is Danny Homan from the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and Tammy Wero, president of the Iowa State Education Association. Also joining by phone is Gretchen Tegler, president of the Taxpayers Association of Central Iowa. This discussion is hosted by Joyce Russell and Dean Borg.
This collective bargaining law was enacted first in 1974. Gretchen Tegler, you have been in state government for some time. You have been in state government, managing the state's Department of Budget and Management, and now you're president of the Central Iowa Taxpayers Association. Can you give us, just because of your perspective from government, and then I'll ask also Senator Schultz and Senator Bolton to give their perspectives on how we got to where we are right now?
Well, thanks, Dean. I did have the opportunity in the last couple of years to ask former Governor Ray about his thoughts when he signed that legislation back in 1974. And he said that he felt it was very important to not have public employees on strike. And that was the reason that he gave for signing the law, that in return for giving up the right to strike, collective bargaining was put in place. So since 1974, I know a lot has changed, and at the time there were a variety of factors that maybe were arguing for some of those provisions. Over the years, however, what's happened, I would just characterize the pendulum has swung, and every year as language is added to collective bargaining contracts that may have something to do with how workers are managed, those provisions stay in there. They are never taken out through an arbitration process unless dollars are given up in return for them. So over time, we've had an accumulation of provisions that make it very difficult for public sector managers to manage. Also, arbitrators have made it clear that a taxpayer, that taxes can always be raised.
We'll get into all of that. And I want to then go to Nate Bolton, who is the Democratic senator from Des Moines, top-ranking Democrat on the Senate's Labor and Business Committee. You've heard just that overview by Gretchen Tegeler now. Do you agree with that, particularly in that things have changed during the intervening years between 74 and now that make changes imperative?
Well, I would agree that it has been a statute that's been in place for 40 years and has served our state well for 40 years. And I think if we're going to make changes to the statute, I think we have to look at how it originally was created through a process of reason and compromise. You had a Republican governor reaching out to Democratic legislators, reaching out to labor groups across the state to make sure we were having a good conversation about a system that would work for all parties and be a fair process for all parties. And if we're going to try to find ways to update or modernize that process, you have to start by bringing all parties back together to make sure it's a process and a system that works for Iowans. So I would say if we're going to talk about modernizing or updating, we have to bring the parties together to do that.
We've heard both the pro and the con there, and I'm going to go to Joyce Russell now, our State House correspondent, because she has some years in the Iowa legislature. And Joyce, what's the history in the Iowa legislature? Have there been attempts to modify Chapter 20? That's the collective bargaining section of the Iowa Code. In other words, is this a pent-up desire for change or what?
Well, to go back a few years, there were some changes in the collective bargaining law during the Culver administration that were passed by a Democratic legislature. However, Governor Culver vetoed those. More recently, in 2011, the Republican-controlled House passed some provisions that were sharply opposed by Democrats, passed the Iowa House on a partisan vote after a long debate, was not taken up by the Democratic Senate. But to answer your question, is there pent-up demand? I believe there is. I mean, this was strongly favored by Republicans all of these years. And now that Republicans have the trifecta, they're free to do that.
So, Joyce, it isn't really a surprise. We knew this was coming.
As recently as the week before, the House Speaker had referred to the upcoming legislation as, she used the word, tilt. Many public workers believed that these were going to be minor changes, and it's definitely not minor.
Well, and I've also heard the word tweaking. We may be tweaking. Jason Schultz, yes. Senator from Schleswig, you're chairing the Senate's Labor and Business Committee, and you'll be managing that bill out on the Senate floor. This is more than tweaking. Are you asking for more than you expect to get?
No, I don't believe so at all. This actually has gone back, for me personally, going back about 8 years. This is my ninth year. But as I would go around my very first year in the legislature talking to superintendents and supervisors, and this Chapter 20 was a topic that came up frequently. And it was a sentiment that the system isn't working anymore, and that they are bound to prior collective bargaining agreements that kind of trap them from doing things to be efficient and to innovate, to try to find new ways to do business.
Well, I'll just go to take an email here, Senator Schultz, that has just come in and that speaks to a question that many people have on their mind and relating just to what we're talking about right now. Larry from Elkader says, this issue seemed to come up unexpectedly. What constituents, there's the key here, if any, have been demanding it? Or is it an outside push from ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council?
Well, I can report here in front of people watching me right here at the table and to the public radio across Iowa, I've never talked to ALEC. I've never been to one of their meetings. I've never seen any of their model legislation. So that's a non-starter. But specific constituents, it would be the office holders. It would be the people that we charge with managing the tax dollars we send them. From superintendents to city councils, county supervisors, all up to the state, AEAs and hospitals included. So it's a pretty broad spectrum of decision makers that are telling me we need to make some changes so that we can do business in the new century.
Well, Senator, there was some criticism last week during the process of the subcommittees and the committees that when it was time for anyone to step forward and argue for this bill, mm-hmm. There was a taxpayers group, the Americans for Prosperity's group, but all of these managers, supervisors, and so forth, we certainly didn't hear from them. So how do you account for that?
They're scared to come forward. That quite literally, I actually literally just 20 minutes ago, 30 minutes ago, spoke to another group who told me privately that they're in favor of this. This is going to help. But their members won't come forward and say anything. And I think
group? Are you willing to say what group that is?
I guess I don't even want to because in the Capitol, it's easy enough to pin down. But we also have, during subcommittee, we have members being intimidated behind. We've got people saying we're going to key their car. We have intimidation tactics going on here, and I'm afraid that this is a case where the legislators are coming forward to do something that requires a little courage, because the people back home are simply intimidated to come forward.
Senator Bolton?
Well, I have a hard time believing that all of these elected officials, county supervisors, city council members, have a hard time of standing up for themselves. These are people that are accountable to voters that are apparently unable to voice those concerns in a legislative process. So I think that may be an overstatement. I know I've talked to county supervisors. I know I have talked to school board members and city council members who have told me they don't want this. They want a positive working relationship with their employees. And from what I've heard from Senator Schultz is, I think, a minimization of what this bill does. It does not just eliminate the history of bargaining. It affirmatively creates new illegal topics for the bargaining process that school board members, county supervisors, city council members cannot discuss with employee representatives about important topics on wages, hours, working conditions, health insurance benefits. This is a major change, and it does fix the outcome, and it makes it a one-sided process.
Gretchen Tegeler, I'm going to ask you to weigh in here,
again,
president of the Central Iowa Taxpayers Association, because I think this question that we've just had from El Cater, apparently you may have had some input there, too, from your members.
Well, I just have to say that, excuse me, I think that the environment is very different today than it once was. I am planning to speak briefly at the public hearing, but my husband was not not completely sure that it would be safe and
safe. You mean your own personal safety?
Yeah, just safe or just a good place to be, a good environment to be. And I mean, that's just a family member expressing a little bit of that concern. But I hadn't even thought of it. But there certainly is some degree of intimidation. And way back in the 90s when we had issues with the unions, that was not present. There was always courtesy and respect shown no matter what the case was. And so I just think nationally and everywhere that speaking on a side that doesn't have such organization behind it as the public sector unions do can be intimidating. So I think there's a little bit to that, and there's definitely anyone who has ever had to manage in the public sector knows exactly how difficult it is and knows that there are so many great employees that just could be excellent and even better if they were in a better working environment where there's a little bit more to it than just time and place, where our modern management tools are available and performance management can be in place. Oh, I think that
as we're talking about intimidation here, I think it's time that we bring in Tammy Worrell, who is president of the Iowa State Education Association, and she serves as the union's president, teacher on leave from Cedar Rapids. And then I'm going to let Joyce follow up with Danny Holman because she's right there with him. Tammy, we've been accused of intimidation, and you had an issue here late last week with email being sent out of the Des Moines Public Schools that called other legislators some very uncomplimentary names, to say the least. Now, that speaks to intimidation. So as you, as an ISEA president and leader, how are you instructing your members to interact with legislators on this? Intimidate by just sheer force, or do you have good arguments?
Well, let me just say that that was not our union that put that letter out. It was unfortunate that that was distributed. It was unfortunate that it was ever written, but that was not the Iowa State Education Association's issue, and that was clarified on KCRG for sure. You know, what I do want to say is people are scared. And they are frightened, and they have no idea what they're going to make next year. They have no idea if their children are going to be covered. I had someone call me late in the night last week whose child is at the University of Iowa Hospitals, and they do not know what plan their family will have starting July 1st. So people are scared, and they're worried, and they feel like they have not had a voice. I will say that our members have sat down and worked with school board, worked with superintendents to try to make a great learning environment for their children, and that has worked well. We have many superintendents who are stepping out and saying this is not what they asked for. They have asked for tweaks in many places. This is not a tweak.
Well, let me follow up just quickly before Joyce questions Danny Holman, but what would you said tweaks? You're willing to accept tweaks. What do you think are you willing to accept in the way of tweaks?
Well, how about the fact that right now, as it is written, a public employee can be let go for any reason at all? So someone who has taught 10 years, but we need to save some money, or we need to hire a football coach and give him a big signing bonus, we maybe don't need the 10-year fourth grade teacher anymore. There is that certainly is not something that is just a tweak. We had heard that there was need for arbitration tweak to look at the ability to pay. Certainly, that's a tweak. And in fact, one legislator thought we were trying to add the ability to pay into arbitration, when actually that's what's in arbitration, as I'm sure Gretchen will talk about. That's a tweak. And let's look at arbitration for those 10 contracts that actually went to arbitration over the last year or so.
Mr. Holman, you are here today taking a break from contract negotiations. And explain to us what the fact that this bill is out there, how is that affecting the negotiations that were already underway?
Well, since one of my attorneys is here, I can't talk about what happens in bargaining, because under the current law as it exists, we can't talk about it. But I will address some things. I guess intimidation is 350 concerned citizens showing up at a forum to talk with their legislator when they won't talk to them, when they say, no, you can still bargain over health insurance. That's not true. That's a blatant lie. We can't. They come and say, we're going to tweak a few things. As Senator Bolton said and Tammy said, this isn't a tweak. They have taken away our ability to bargain. And then some legislators have said, and I'm really glad to meet you, Jason Schultz, this is the first time I've ever met you, are saying that they have met with AFSCME Union to discuss this bill. We've never had a meeting with anybody about this bill. I think the difference between today and 1974 is what Senator Bolton alluded to. There were 12 days of debate. We won't have 12 hours of debate. We didn't get to see this bill until they dropped it last Tuesday, and they're going to pass it this week.
Danny, what would you hope to accomplish? Danny, what would you hope to accomplish if you had had a chance to talk with Senator Schultz or others who were crafting the legislation? What, and I asked the same question I asked of Tammy, what would you be willing to accept and you think may be necessary in tweaking or adjusting and updating Iowa's current law?
Well, I'd like to sit down with fair-minded people who want to have a fair conversation about what they see as a problem. Show me what the problem is, Dean. Our union, over the last 40 years that we have been in existence, has always been willing to sit down and have conversations with legislators, be it Governor Branstad or Governor Culver, Governor Vilsack. The second Governor Vilsack or Branstad term, we haven't had a conversation with him.
I wanted to give Senator Schultz a chance to respond to that. I heard that in the committee that you had sat down and talked with certain unions. And here we have Mr. Homan saying that you didn't talk to him. So do you want to respond to that?
I believe there were leadership meetings. There were people, the issues coming up during the session. And that the feedback that I've received from that was that there was going to be no changes accepted or not resisted.
And Ms. Morrow and Mr. Homan are shaking. Ms. Warrow, Mr. Homan are shaking their heads.
Never been contacted.
She says she's never been contacted.
We did meet with leadership, and we asked them if there was going to be a bill. We asked them if we would be able to have input, and we were told no. That was the meeting.
In our Des Moines studio at the Law Library at the Capitol, we have Jason Schultz, a Republican senator from Schleswig, Nate Bolton, Democratic senator from Des Moines, Tammy Warrow. She's president of the Iowa State Education Association, Danny Homan, who's president of ASME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Union. Gretchen Tegler's on the phone. She's the president of Central Iowa Taxpayers Association. And in our Ames studio, we've got a cast of thousands here, Katie Swalwell. And she's an Iowa State University assistant professor of education who's been researching the effects of Wisconsin's recent actions in that state's collective bargaining laws regarding public employees. Hello, Professor Swalwell.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
What have you found in researching?
Sure. Just a couple things, too, before in responding. I was listening to the conversation earlier, and I appreciated Senator Schultz saying that in response to the email that he himself hasn't been inspired by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. But when I look at these issues, I'm looking from more of a macro perspective, and really what's happening in Iowa fits a much larger pattern regionally of very similar legislation. The case that I'm most familiar with is in Wisconsin, which is very, very similar legislation as to what's being proposed in Iowa.
Define just a little bit more. You said a larger pattern in Iowa. I didn't quite catch the implication there.
Sure. So this, I guess, attack on collective bargaining and these proposed changes to collective bargaining and changes to public sector unions started maybe six, seven years ago, really a series of Republican governors in the Midwest, in Indiana, in Ohio, eventually in Wisconsin, proposing really similar legislation or changes to executive orders that had previously encouraged collective bargaining. So there's a larger pattern at play. And when we look at the history, I think it was 1974 that Governor Ray signed Chapter 20, that the year previous to that, 1973, was when ALEC was formed. And currently, over 1,000 bills across the country are based on templates that ALEC is creating. And one of the templates that they have created is legislation like this to restrict collective bargaining. So
just define, ALEC is an acronym mm-hmm. for the American Legislative Exchange Council.
Mm-hmm. Yep, right. And it's an organization that a lot of corporations pay to belong to. The purpose is to write legislation that will promote free market kinds of principles and solutions and to really focus on privatizing public goods and services. So I believe Mr. Schultz that he himself was not inspired by that, but I just wanted to point out that this is a broader context regionally that's happening and nationally that's happening, that it isn't just Iowa.
Specifically in Wisconsin, are there quantifiable effects?
Yes. My study has really looked at what's happened to teachers' professional lives and what's going on with their ability to teach and reach students post Act 10. So more of a symbolic impact, and I'm happy to talk more about that. In terms of teacher turnover, we know that 75% of districts in Wisconsin are losing their teachers after Act 10 because a competitive or competing district has offered a better salary or benefits. And this teacher turnover actually is hitting rural districts and districts with declining enrollment much harder than suburban districts. Lower income districts are hit much harder than wealthier districts. And even for large urban districts, it's tricky because they're so large, they have so many teachers that they can't compete to offer staying bonuses to everyone who might be recruited away.
Professor Swalwell, pause right there. Put sure. yourself on the hold button, and I'm going to ask Republican Senator from Schleswig, the chair manager of the collective bargaining legislation in the Senate debate. Jason Schultz, you heard what she said about the effects in Wisconsin. How do you answer that, and are you afraid? You're from a rural area, Schleswig.
I am, and I sat in a room with nearly every superintendent in the Senate district here just 2 weeks ago, when school administrators of Iowa came up, and all of them expressed support for this. They're not worried about this urban versus rural. They're looking for the opportunity to manage their schools. However, I think it should be always pointed out that any effect that happened in Wisconsin has something to do with the $1 billion cut in funding that happened immediately following Act 10. Now, Act 10, and we're actually not filing or we're not running a bill now that mirrors Wisconsin, but Act 10 set in place a framework similar to this because similar problems have similar solutions. So to see that there are similarities between different states' approaches. Well, it's hard not to have that happen. But when you take $1 billion out of their budget for, I believe it was just education, you're going to have ramifications like that. And part of Act 10 was in order to allow the decision maker in each school to make local decisions that best mitigated the effect at their local school.
And I'm going to ask also Gretchen Tegeler to weigh in on this because you're one of the proponents of adjusting Chapter 20. You've just heard what happened in Wisconsin. You've heard the response of Senator Schultz. But what would you say, Gretchen Tegeler? Does this frighten you about the effect on the educational system?
No, it doesn't. Iowa's education funding provides the same per pupil funding across the state. Districts under the proposed changes would then be able to decide how they wanted to go forward and implement some of these changes. There's also, I'm not sure if those on the call have seen, there's the beginning of some research on student achievement, and there's an economist from Stanford University, economic researcher Barbara Biasi, who is doing a study awaiting peer review that takes a look at the impact on student achievement and kind of gets into what happened in Wisconsin in some detail about what some of the shifting was all about. And districts that did make some changes to recruit and retain high value-added teachers, the ones who most improve student learning, were attracting teachers, and some of the districts that continued to just administer pay raises across the board without regard to, market demand for STEM teachers or educational accomplishment.
Okay, Gretchen, I'm going to interrupt
so
there.
I think I'm not afraid of it.
Okay, I'm going to go back to Professor Swalwell and ask specifically then, what's the effect on the flexibility of state and local government to manage their public employees, and is there a measurable effect? Two questions here. Measurable effect on academic performance in Wisconsin schools.
Yeah, I've actually seen that study that Gretchen mentioned, and there are a couple of other studies coming out too, very, very preliminary data about student achievement data. And what seems to be the trend is that in districts, again, wealthier districts that can pay bonuses to recruit teachers that they consider to be high-performing, have some minimal impact on math achievement scores is what's been looked at thus far. What's happening is the rural districts and especially the border districts, either districts on the Minnesota border, for instance, where teachers don't have to move in order to switch jobs, or districts such as Perry or Grimes, where teachers could work in Des Moines and not have to move, those border districts are actually really struggling to fill positions to be able to recruit teachers. So the attrition of teachers considered to be highly performing is going to districts that are wealthier, where the achievement rates tend to be higher anyway for all sorts of reasons that are related to another topic for another day. So this minimal achievement is happening at the expense of districts that can't afford to recruit and retain teachers. And I think the budget deficit, it was actually a $750 million cut to public education. You know, we haven't had a cut necessarily here in Iowa, but we definitely didn't have the increase that was requested. So thinking about the financial position that school districts are in, rural districts, districts with declining enrollment are really going to find it very difficult to compete with districts that have the ability to pass bond referendums, that are wealthier districts to begin with. That this achievement effect seems to only work for the districts that are able to recruit these student or these teachers, and the effect seems fairly small, and the researchers have been cautioning against making judgments without being able to look a little bit longer term.
Thank you, Professor Swalwell. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. That gives us a good overview. Thank you for that research and for enunciating it very clearly. Tammy Worrell, that should ring a bell in your corner.
It certainly does. I'm actually kind of confused now why Gretchen thinks that this would be helpful. Iowa has the highest graduation rate in the nation. We are doing wonderful things with actually less money in many of our districts. Our rural districts have seen declining enrollment, and they are receiving less dollars. We have transportation costs that are way out of line, and our children are on buses for hours because of our rural communities needing to consolidate. Our ACT scores are between 1 and 2 in the nation as well. We are doing great things in Iowa, and I am confused how what was explained as a way to save taxpayers' money. I didn't hear any money savings in that. In fact, all I've heard today were some organizations that actually have my tax dollars pay their dues. Some of them thought this was a good idea. I want to be clear, a difference between Wisconsin and Iowa in their bill and ours is that Iowa unions are a choice for our members. That was not a choice in Wisconsin. Our members have chosen to be members of our unions, and they don't have to be if they don't want to be. And every non-member receives the same wages and the same benefits as a member does.
Tammy, I'm bringing on the line here for all of our guest speakers, not just you, but I want to hear from Aaron Independence. He's talking about local control. Thank you very much, Aaron, for waiting so long. I'm going to bring you on the air and ask your question.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a young teacher and the teacher in Waterloo. I'm now a stay-at-home dad, and my wife is a music teacher. And for us, I mean, this obviously affects us because we have an income we can, you know, we count on. And we met with our local representatives, and they brought up this issue of, yeah, local control. And what I don't understand, though, is how this is actually going to benefit us. Because this idea of local control is that, well, you know, we could get more money as teachers. But, you know, if it's just up to each district, you're right. Some districts have the resources, and they can pay more. But what if, you know, for our family, they decide, well, music isn't that important to us, so we're not going to pay you as much. And that really has an effect on our family. And I don't see, you know, in a business that works, sure, we want businesses that do well to do better.
What
but our education?
Aaron, what scares you? I'm failing to get the point that you're making. What scares you the most about this?
Well, we're just leaving it up to individual districts. I mean, it's not to say we can't have a conversation about how could, you know, teachers get paid more, because as a young teacher, sure, I put in, you know, a lot of extra time, and in the end, I got paid less just because of my time. But that conversation shouldn't just, you know, be held at, you know, up to each individual school. I mean, that's a conversation we could have as
all right.
A state
I think
and with our union.
I think we've got, and we're going back to our panel. Thank you, Aaron from Independence, for expressing your views to us. Joyce?
Ms. Warrow, currently rural districts are already at a disadvantage compared to urban districts. That's already a problem and has been for a long time. So how is this going to exacerbate that?
Well, I think what our caller was saying was in a rural district right now, a teacher can go there and move their family there and trust that they know what they're going to make when they purchase a home. They know what type of insurance they have if their husband's a farmer or owns their own small business like my husband does. They are secure in some pieces of that. In a rural community, if they decide that music is not as valuable, what could happen is that music teacher could get a deduction, say lose $10,000 in their salary, while other teachers continue to make more. There is nothing that would keep a teacher to feel secure where they're living. So they would continue to follow the money, follow where a bonus might be, go somewhere else. And that would be a dramatic impact.
Senator Schultz, did you have a response to that?
Well, the item that was left in mandatory negotiating would have been wages, which
base
has
wage.
Arbitration there.
Yeah, your base wage. What's the definition of that, Senator?
It's the base wage. It's
right.
the bottom line.
33.5.
This is what we're going to pay. So to say that you could lose $10,000 is inaccurate.
Senator, I would argue it is not inaccurate.
Well, we disagree on that. However, I do believe it is up to the local school beyond base wage, who they reward. They're good teachers that they can reward. This is an opportunity for schools to run more efficiently and to reward good teachers. And if somebody's not performing up to standard, they can look for a place where maybe their skills are more better suited.
Senator Bolton?
A couple points here. First of all, talking about base wages, base wages probably wouldn't change that much, but most teachers aren't making just the base wage. Their incomes will be affected by a unilateral policy shift that will be instated by their school districts, and they won't have a voice at the table. They won't have a voice in determining their health insurance anymore. Those are big deals, and it's going to be a real problem to recruit quality teachers to rural school districts when we add uncertainty to the profession. And I heard a lot of comments about intimidation, and what we're really inviting, where people are going to be really intimidated, is at their workplace. People are going to be fearful of reprisals in this system because we're cutting out cause for termination. We're limiting the voice at the bargaining table. So when we talk about fears and we talk about intimidation, the real fear I'm worried about is the fear and apprehension that a school teacher or a public sector employee who has chosen to live out the calling of public service, now constantly looking over their shoulder, knowing they could be fired without reason, and they may not have the benefits that they have worked to earn over their livelihood.
Joyce, that's something I can speak to in terms of, at least in Wisconsin, what we are noticing in terms of the impact of Act 10 has been absolutely a greater workload for teachers. Most of the teachers in our study reported having at least at the high school and middle school level, an additional 30 students on their workload. So you have increased class sizes, you have more grading, you have less time and attention to spend on individual students. I think it's worth remembering that collective bargaining agreements typically include much more than wages and benefits, but also include extracurricular duties, prep time, collaboration time, grievances, how you can file those, and as the senator said, also reasons that you can be fired. And one of the most common themes that we heard in our interviews was teachers, even teachers that were very, very confident with over 20 years of experience, you know, felt very valued by their communities, expressed a lot of fear that they wouldn't be able to teach the same way that they had before. They wouldn't be willing to push students in critical thinking. They wouldn't have either the time or the feeling of confidence that if they, you know, angered the wrong person on the school board or an administrator, that they could be removed without cause and they wouldn't have a way to file a grievance. So,
I'm going to interrupt here just for a second because I want to move on and we're running out of time. There is one of the arguments for those wanting to change Chapter 20 is that as a school board, for example, comes in negotiating with teachers, they first go to an impasse if they can't agree. Then they go to an arbitrator, and both sides
teachers' union and the school board submits a package of proposal to an arbitrator. The arbitrator does not have the flexibility to go back and say, would you amend this package a little bit? I think we can find agreement. That arbitrator must choose one or the other. And one of the criteria for choosing is, does the payor, does a school board in this case, have the ability to pay? Well, they can assess the taxpayers. And so he'll choose that package. He or she, the arbitrator, chooses that package because the taxpayer can always foot the bill. I'm asking you then, Senator Bolton, make the case that Iowans should be paying for an arbitrator's decision that the taxpayer has deep pockets.
Well, I think there's a little bit of a misstatement there, Dean, in that an arbitrator is only going to look at how we can raise taxes to afford whatever the union is asking for in a negotiation. In fact, I would say the opposite is happening. Arbitrators are looking at the history of the bargaining process and how the parties have come to this reasonable proposal that they are saying is on the table. And it's not an exclusive factor of can the school district go out and raise taxes. In fact, I think arbitrators have every incentive to avoid that as the standard. They're looking at the history of bargaining. They're looking at comparable employees and making sure that the reasonable proposal that's on the table is considered. What this legislation does is actually removes a lot of the arbitrator's ability to consider what evidence that makes these proposals reasonable, and then fixes an outcome to a very limited number of possible awards, basically saying that at best, in the highest of economic times when the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, has increased dramatically, teachers, public employees are going to be limited to a 3% increase at best. That's
Senator
what an arbitrator
Schultz?
Can do.
Senator
no,
Schultz, I'll give you
no,
a chance.
No, this bill actually, as we were putting it together, I keep saying local control because this is what we were working on. A school board can give any raise it wants. It can do whatever it would like. But if it goes to arbitration, there is a cap there, because if the state doesn't have the money to fill in state aid, if the property taxpayers can't go anymore, they have the ability. We put a cap in there to protect in arbitration so that the taxpayer isn't told you have to pay up. But voluntary packages are completely at their will.
So it's only at arbitration where that cap kicks in.
Yes.
Senator Bolton?
But I'll tell you what, and this is why this legislation needs more time and consideration, because there are parts of this bill and this legislation that actually restricts the application to minimal interpretations. And I think that there's a possibility out there that a school board can say, hey, this proposal is over and above what an arbitrator could possibly be awarding. You are actually asking for something that is a bad faith proposal, and we don't think we are going to consider any other evidence. I think that's dangerous for school districts.
Senator Nate Bolton with Senator Jason Schultz from the talk show River to River, hosted by Dean Borg and Joyce Russell. This is from Monday afternoon in a quiet room at the Capitol's Law Library. This is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the Iowa legislative session. I'm John Pimble. It is now the sixth week of the session. All the major initiatives Republicans have wanted, specifically those asked for by Governor Terry Branstad, are passing the House and Senate on party lines. These chambers are very divided right now. For this bill proposing changes to collective bargaining, the Democrats entered amendments in order to stall. They say time is needed to make changes to the bill. None of these amendments passed during the hours and hours of debate. The debate started Tuesday night in both the House and Senate chamber. They are discussing the same bill at the same time. This is not unprecedented, but it's certainly not the normal procedure. It starts in the Senate.
I'd like to thank my colleagues in the Senate for what has been and will likely be a spirited discussion about Senate File 213.
Senator Jason Schultz is the bill's floor manager and introduces the legislation.
It will allow state and local officials to develop employment contracts that make sense for taxpayers and employees. It will allow the state, city governments, county boards of supervisors, and school boards to innovate with the times, reward their best employees, and manage their finances without fear the unions or unelected arbitrators will stand in the way. This bill will also increase worker freedom and union accountability in Iowa. State and local governments should not be the banker for big labor. The unions are using taxpayer dollars to collect union dues and political action dollars from government employee union members. This system needs to change.
After Senator Schultz's opening remarks, the body has to consider the many amendments from the Democratic opposition. For the next 3 days, the Senate spends almost every minute of debate time on these amendments. Many are authored by Senator Nate Bolton.
This amendment, 3021, is our last chance to stop the freight train that is barreling towards Iowa workers right now. We finally arrived at the point of no return on this.
Most of these amendments want to keep bargaining the same for all public workers instead of the proposed changes where those in higher-risk jobs like police officers and firefighters would be able to negotiate differently than a teacher or a social worker. Other amendments want to table the bill pending more study or to add a delay of a year on becoming law once it is signed. The specifics of each amendment gets a bit complicated, but mostly the debate focuses on why the Democrats oppose the changes to collective bargaining.
This bill blows up a system that has been working for this state for 40 years. It's served us well for four decades. This is a system that was born out of a spirit of compromise. A Republican governor, Governor Robert Ray, celebrated his achievement in signing this statute. That legacy is long gone today. It's disappointing to see what is happening here, as we see a Republican majority ready to gut a system that has served our state well.
The debate on Tuesday night is about one amendment. It lasts 4.5 hours and at times becomes very aggressive.
The chair recognizes Senator from Polk, Senator Bisignano.
Senator Tony Bisignano delivers a 26-minute speech. He closes by attacking the Republicans and Governor Branstad's long interest in changing collective bargaining laws. The gallery above the chamber is full of visitors opposing the bill, including many union members, and Senator Bisignano's speech energizes them.
I don't get this bill. It's mean-spirited. It's ugly. It's an attack on workers. This whole state has been nothing but an attack on workers and normal people all year. And the only good thing to come out of this election is that we're getting rid of this governor who's been a mean-spirited governor to public employees.
Senator Bisignano is referring to the election of President Trump, who has chosen Governor Branstad to be the ambassador to China, which means Governor Branstad is about to resign.
And hopefully the new governor will look at the people of Iowa as their friends and as their neighbors and as their family, because you cannot say you love Iowa and you hate Iowans.
Senator Rich Taylor says the bill's intentions are not to modify, but to end collective bargaining.
It's supposed to be collective bargaining reform. Well, I call it bullshit. This is not collective bargaining reform. This is a direct attack on public employees. This is calling war against everybody you see up in these galleries in front of me and behind me. This is war on these people. This is not right. And I'll tell you what, you know, they say all's fair in love and war. Well, the war's just starting, and I'm hoping that you're really prepared for that, because this isn't going to be pretty.
In the House, the attacks continue on the bill from Representative Bruce Hunter.
House File 291, in my opinion, is the most egregious, hateful, vengeful piece of legislation I have ever seen since I've been here.
Like in the Senate, the House Democrats propose many amendments. Representative Hunter's is the first.
Amendment 1018 would strike down House File 291 and bring us back to Chapter 20 as it stands now.
At 10:30 p.m., after a couple of hours of debate, the bill is temporarily deferred, which means the representatives can leave. But the next morning, they resume with Representative Sharon Steckman.
Wow,
Last night, we almost gave Iowa workers and families the worst Valentine's Day present ever, but we put it off to today, I guess.
Representative Walt Rogers says the bill should pass because it will recognize good employees.
The present system that we have, I think, rewards what I call the lowest common denominator of employees. I've heard that we want to level the playing field, that collective bargaining is the only way to level the playing field. Well, leveling the playing field puts all employees at the same type of atmosphere, makes them all the same. We don't want to do that. We want employees to shine.
The debate continues through Wednesday evening, and eventually they adjourn. This is not the case in the Senate. They started debate Wednesday morning and argue all night. On Thursday morning, Senator Herman Korbach introduces another amendment.
Good morning, D-Morn. It is 6:11 in the a.m. The sun is about to come up. Time to get up out of bed, milk the cows, and get to work. We got 10 amendments down and only 42 to go. Let's get going. Buckle up.
To be clear, there are breaks from the discussion during this time in the Senate. The parties go to caucus, for example. They do adjourn Thursday morning at 9:45, but 2 minutes later they convene. One of the first orders of business comes from Majority Leader Senator Bill Dix.
I move that a time certain be set for the close of debate and that the Senate act on all amendments and amendments to amendments and any motions thereto. Filed to Senate File 213 no later than 2 p.m. on Thursday, February 16th, 2017, and then immediately proceed to a substitution if available. Then, final passage on the bill under consideration.
The House also files a time certain for noon that day. Democrats offer an amendment to extend debate until next week, but the Republicans' time certain parameters pass. Both chambers have only a few hours to finish. Dozens of amendments are voted down. In the House, floor manager of the collective bargaining bill, Representative Stephen Holt, speaks during the closing remarks.
It is because, in many cases, we have simply inadvertently created a system that discourages innovation and instead simply protects the status quo. The changes to the scope of bargaining will help unleash innovation. In the prohibited list, such things as transfer procedures, evaluation procedures, procedures for staff reduction, subcontracting for public services, and supplemental pay give our state agencies and locally elected officials the dynamic management tools they must have to be innovative.
It passes on a voice vote. All but six Republicans vote for it. The bill is messaged to the Senate. An hour later, Senator Jason Schultz asks for a vote to change the Senate's bill to the one just passed in the House.
I move that House File 291 be substituted for Senate File 213.
As Senate President Jack Woodford opens the electronic voting system, Rule 23 is called out, which means the bill's substitution has to be voted on by a voice vote. As the clerk reads the senators' names for a yes or no, some voice their disdain for the legislation.
Senator Bolcom.
Spectators seated above in the gallery cheer.
The Senate will be in order.
The votes are tallied, and the results are along party lines, Senator with Bolcom, one independent senator voting against the bill.
The Senate will pay attention to the result of the vote. Those voting aye, 29. Those voting no, 21. The motion is adopted. Senate House File 291 will substitute Senate File 213.
The bill isn't passed yet, but the spectators take this moment to voice disapproval.
The Senate will be in order. The Senate will be in order. The chair recognizes a senator. What? The chair recognizes Senator from Crawford, Senator Schultz.
Mr. President, I move that House File 291 be read for the last time and placed on its passage.
Those in favor of the motion say aye. Those opposed say no. The motion prevails. The secretary will read.
House File 291, a bill for enacting employment matters involving public employees, including collective bargaining, educator employment matters, personal records, settlement agreements, city civil service requirements, health insurance matters, making penalties applicable, including effective date applicability and transition provisions, being enacted by the General Assembly, State of Iowa.
The senator from Crawford moves that the reading thus far be considered the last reading of the bill. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye!
A record roll call vote has been requested. The secretary will open the voting system and receive your vote. Rule 23 has been requested. The secretary will close the voting system and call the roll.
After the vote agreeing this is the last reading, the passage of the bill
Senator
comes
Allen.
Before the Senate. Again, Rule 23 is demanded.
Senator
Again,
Anderson.
The senators voice their vote.
Senator
Final tally,
Bain.
29 for, 21 against. It passes at 2:52 Thursday afternoon. Less than 24 hours later, Governor Terry Branstad signs the collective bargaining bill into law. This is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the Iowa legislature. I'm John Pimble. Now that the bill is signed, 180,000 public workers will see changes to how their contracts are negotiated from this date forward. 6 years ago, something similar happened in Wisconsin as part of legislation known as Act 10. Iowa Public Radio's Morning Edition host Clay Masters speaks with Wisconsin Public Radio Statehouse reporter Sean Johnson to discuss how Act 10 changed Wisconsin.
So what has that 2011 law done to, for example, teachers' unions in Wisconsin?
Before 2011, teachers' unions were a major political force in Wisconsin. They kind of balanced out the Chamber of Commerce in races for governor, races for the legislature. You know, they were a powerhouse. They were a force to be reckoned with, and they're not anymore. You know, the teachers union here now, they may help organize, they may deliver a message at the Capitol, but it doesn't come with sort of that fear factor for their opponents, because they're just not a force in legislative or state races anymore. They don't have the bank account, frankly.
So it's impacted elections there in Wisconsin.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in 2017, looking back, you kind of realize now what a big part of the Democratic playbook unions were when it came to winning elections, because it's not just the teachers union. You look at our state employees union, which has fractured, and you know, there are still unions representing state employees, but again, they lack the clout that they once had. Unions can still get involved in elections here. They have. They probably will again in 2018. Assuming Governor Scott Walker runs, they're going to want to try to defeat him again. But they rely on outside contributions, you know, from the national office, for example. They just can't raise that money on their own.
What about other public sector unions in general? Do they really have much of a say anymore in their contract negotiations?
Not too much, really. I mean, part of the reason that this law has undermined unions is not only that it makes it harder for them to remain organized. You know, they have to take these annual recertification votes in Wisconsin. That's a difficult hurdle for them to cross. But it's also made it harder for them to get anything for their members. So they can't go out and get better health insurance. They can't go out and get better retirement benefits. Those things are really spelled out by the law now. And so for the union, their role in getting more for members has been minimized.
Iowa got a lot of time with your governor, Scott Walker, when he was running for president a couple years ago. How has he been perceived since all of this went down there?
I think you can say that Governor Walker has survived any backlash from his collective bargaining law. I mean, it was shocking when he first came into office because he didn't talk about it in his 2010 campaign, and they passed it really quickly in 2011. But he survived a recall campaign in 2012, and he survived a reelection campaign in 2014. So that law by itself hasn't hurt him. I think he'd argue that it helped him. There's a couple things going for Republicans here in Wisconsin that have made it easier for them to win elections and harder for Democrats. You've got simultaneously this union bargaining law that's undercut really the Democrats' strength in Wisconsin elections. At the same time, Republicans drew the legislative maps in 2011, so that's made it hard to win at the legislative level. So Governor Scott Walker is likely going to run for re-election again in 2018. if he's vulnerable in that race in ways that he hasn't been in the past, it would probably be because he spent so much time in Iowa running for a different job a couple years ago. If that lingers in people's minds, that could hurt him, because that's really when we saw his approval rating drop here in Wisconsin.
Sean Johnson from Wisconsin Public Radio speaking with Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters. Iowa's new collective bargaining law was expected to pass and become law quickly. Last week, the likely possibility of its passage started affecting union bargaining units for teachers. In order to beat the ramifications of the new law in eastern Iowa, the Mount Vernon District rushed to have contracts finalized, a process that normally would not take place at this time. A third of the staff will not see salary increases because representatives from the state union, ISEA, say they settled for a two-year stable contract instead of higher pay. The union conducted negotiations in just a few days to avoid complications with the law that went into effect on Friday. This is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the Iowa legislative session. It's not an all-encompassing everything under the dome show. I mean, if it were, this week's entry would be 50 or 60 hours, or the amount of time the Senate and House debated a single bill. We do, however, try to give you a point of view of what it's like to be in the Capitol while an issue is being proposed, discussed, brought to life, or destroyed. We plan to be here for 13 weeks, depending on how long this first half of the 87th Iowa General Assembly lasts. Stories for today's show are from Joyce Russell, Clay Masters, Sarah Bowden, and talk show host Dean Borg. We get a hand now and then from our friend at Radio Iowa, Kay Henderson. We appreciate your help, Kay. The concept for Under the Golden Dome comes from Catherine Perkins. I'm John Pemble. Our next Under the Golden Dome podcast comes out next Friday from iowapublicradio.org.